He said, thinks, knows what it is. He said, was mind.
She was breaking up, her dead speak scattering for the last time. Harry knew. Ma! He was anxious.
Mobius said was the mind, Harry.
The mind, Ma? Did you say the mind? She tried to answer but couldn't quite make it out. All that came back was the faintest of all far distant fading whispers.
Harry! Harry!
Then silence. Paxton had read the Necroscope's case file and knew quite a lot about him. Most of it would seem unbelievable to people of entirely mundane persuasions, but of course Paxton wasn't one of them. On the far bank of the river, he watched Harry through a pair of binoculars and thought, "The strange sod is talking to his mother, a woman dead for a quarter of a century and long since turned to slop, Jesus. And they say telepathy is weird." Harry heard him and knew that he'd been eavesdropping on his conversation with his mother, on Harry's part of it anyway, and suddenly he was furious, but coldly furious, not like the other night. And again Faithor's words of advice sprang to memory.
"He would enter your mind, enter his."
Paxton saw the Necroscope step behind a bush and waited for him to come out on the other side, but he didn't. "Taking a leak?" the Esper wondered. "Actually, no," said Harry softly, from directly behind him. "But when I do, I'd like to think it's in private." "What?" The mind spy whirled around, stumbled, staggered on the very rim of the river. Harry reached out easily and caught the front of his jacket, steadied him, grinned an utterly mirthless grin at him. He looked him up and down, a small, thin, withered-looking stick of a man in his middle to late 20s, with the face and eyes of a weasel. His telepathy must be old Mars nature's way of making up for several sorts of deficiency. "Paxton," Harry said, his voice still dangerously soft, a hot breath squeezed out of burning bellows lungs. "You're a scum-sucking little mind flea. I reckon that when your father made you, the best part leaked from a ruptured rubber down your Mars leg onto the floor of the brothel. You're a scumbag bastard who has invaded my territory, stepped on my toes, and is making me itch. And I have every right to do something about you. Don't you agree?" Paxton flapped his mouth like a landed fish, finally got his breath and his nerve back.
I'm doing my job, that's all,"
he gasped, trying to free himself from Harry's grip. But the Necroscope just held him there at arm's length, held him that much tighter, with no real expenditure of energy at all. "Doing your job," he repeated Paxton's words. "Who for, scumbag?"
"That's none of your business,"
Paxton started to say. Harry shook him, glared at him, and for the first time the Esper noticed a flush of red light colouring the Necroscope's gaunt cheeks where it escaped from behind the thick lenses of his dark glasses. An angry red light from his eyes. "Free branch!" Harry's voice was lower still, a rumble, almost a growl.
"Yes, no,"
Paxton blurted the words out. Soft as jelly, all he wanted now was to get away from here. To that end, he'd say anything at all, the first thing that came to mind. Harry knew it, could read it in his pale face and trembling lips. But where lips may lie, the mind usually tells the truth. He went inside and got out again like squelching from the sucking quag of a sewer. Even through the acrid odour of Paxton's fear, still he'd been able to smell the shit. It was a relief to know that such minds were in the minority, otherwise the Necroscope might be tempted to declare war on the entire human race right now. But Paxton knew he'd been in. He'd felt Harry in there, like slivers of ice in his mind. He started imitating a fish again. "So now you know for sure," said Harry. "And now your report to your boss. Well, you go and tell the minister that his worst nightmare has come true, Paxton. Tell him that, and then quit. Get out and stay out. I know you don't warn too easily, but this time take good advice and run while you can. I won't be warning you again." And while that sank in, he released the other, released him violently, and tossed him back and over the lip of the river and down into the gently swirling water. It was only then that the necroscope saw Paxton's briefcase lying open on a tree stump close by, several white junk mail envelopes and one large manila envelope were like magnets to his eyes. They were addressed to Harry Keogh, number 3, Riverside, etc., etc. Harry glared once more at the floundering Esper where he gagged, gurgled and splashed in the cold river water beyond his reach, for the moment just out of harm's way, then snatched up his mail and took it home with him. Paxton could swim, which was as well, for the necroscope didn't much care one way or the other. Chapter 6. Red Alert. Harry flipped quickly through the murder files, discovered the young prostitute's name, hometown, and place of internment, and made his way at once to her graveside in a small cemetery on the northern outskirts of Newcastle. And the necroscope had moved so quickly that as he seated himself in the shade of a tree close to Pamela Trotter's simple headstone, Paxton was still catching his breath where he'd dragged himself onto the riverbank 100 miles away. "Pamela," said the necroscope, "I'm Harry Keogh. I believe my mother might have mentioned my name to you."
"Your mother and others?"
she came back at once.
"I've been expecting you, Harry, and I've been warned off you too."
Harry nodded, perhaps ruefully. "My reputation has suffered a bit lately, it's true." She chuckled.
"Mine suffered a lot. For nearly 6 years, in fact, ever since I was 14, and a nice uncle showed me his little pink sprinkler and told me where it went. Actually, I seduced him, for I'd noticed that whenever he was near me, he had a hard-on. But if it hadn't have been him, it would have been someone else, because I was just naturally like that. We played around a lot, until his old lady caught us at it one day, the jealous old bat. I was going bouncy-bouncy on him when she walked in. He whipped it out, but was too far gone and spurted on the carpet. I don't think she'd seen him spurt for a long time, and she'd certainly never had it like that. Come to think of it, I don't think he had either. Not before me. But I liked it always. It helps when you enjoy your work."
Harry was silent for a moment, surprised, even a little taken aback. He really didn't know how to answer her.
"Didn't your ma tell you I was a tart, a trollop, a whore?"
There was no bitterness in her, not even much of sadness, and Harry liked her for it. "Something like that," he answered eventually. "Not that I think it matters a great deal. There have to be a hell of a lot of you down there by now." She laughed, and Harry liked her even more.
"The oldest profession?"
she said. "But one night, nearly 8 weeks ago, it caught up with you, right?" He felt that with her he could get right to it. Her assumed indifference fell away from her at once.
"That wasn't why it happened," she said. "I didn't fetch him on, and anyway he didn't want me like that."
"It was just an assumption," Harry told her quickly. "I mean, no offence, and I'm not eager to bring back hurtful memories, but it's hard to see how I can track this bloke down if no one is able to tell me about him."
"Oh, I'd like to see him get his, Harry,"
she answered.
"And I'll help you any way I can. I just hope I can remember enough, that's all."
"You won't know until you try."
"Where do you want me to start?"
"First, show me how you were, or how you thought you were," he said, for he knew well enough that the dead retained pictures of themselves as they were in life, and he wanted to try and draw some sort of comparison with Penny Sanderson. In short, he wondered if his necromancer quarry followed a pattern. From her mind, he immediately got back a picture of a tall, dark-eyed, leggy brunette in a miniskirt, with slightly loose breasts unsupported under a blue silk blouse and a shapely backside. But there was nothing of character in the picture. Her picture, nothing to suggest quality of mind or personality. It was all sensual or outright sexual, which didn't fit with his first impressions.
"So, how was I?"
"Very attractive," he told her. "But I think you're selling yourself short."
"Often,"
she agreed, but without her customary laugh. Then she sighed, and that was something Harry was used to in the dead. It was the realization of a time and a thing done and finished with, which could never return. But she brightened up at once. And here I am actually talking to a man, and for once not wondering what he's got in his pants, in front and in the back pocket.
Was it always like that, for money?
And sometimes for fun. I've told you, I was an info. Do you want to get it on now?
Harry was embarrassed. She'd given him a stock answer, had obviously heard the question before, often. Was I prying?
It's okay,
she answered.
All men wonder about it, about what goes on in a pro's mind.
But suddenly her dead speak was very cold.
All men except that one, anyway. He doesn't have to wonder, for he can always find out for himself, afterwards, when they're dead.
And with that, the necroscope was sure she'd give him all she could.
Tell me about it, he said.
And she did.
It was a Friday night and I went to the dance. Since I was freelance, my time was my own. I didn't need a pimp touting for me, taking my money and bringing his friends round for freebies. But the dance was in town and I live quite a few miles away. After the midnight hour, taxis are expensive. Cinders needed her coach home. That was okay. There are always a handful of likely lads who buzz a girl on the chance of a grope. And if I liked the guy, and if he wasn't too pushy, maybe he could get more than a grope. A ride for a ride, as the saying goes. On this occasion, I picked up the wrong one. No, not our man, but an armful all the same. Once I was in the car, his polite, concerned attitude went right out of the window. He didn't know what I was, thought I was just a straight kid, but easy meat. He could hardly drive for drooling and wanted to stop in every lay-by and back alley. I was wearing expensive clothes and didn't want them ripped up. And anyway, I didn't like him. He said he knew a place just off the motorway, and before I could tell him I didn't need it, he took the fly on for Edinburgh. In a lay-by by some trees, he made his move, and he got my knee in his soft bits for his trouble. When he could drive again, he did, but left me stranded there. There was a service station a quarter of a mile up the motorway. I went there and had coffee. I wasn't shaken up or anything, just dehydrated. Too many gin and its at the palace. But sitting there in this little booth, I was joined by a driver. That was how I saw him, a driver. A long-distance man shaking off his weariness with a mug of coffee. Don't ask me what he looked like. The place was three-quarters empty, and they'd turned the lights low to keep the bills down, and there was a lot of gin in me. I spoke to him, but I didn't really look at him, you know. Anyway, he didn't seem a bad sort, and he wasn't pushy. When he finished his coffee and made to stand up, I asked him which way he was heading. "Where do you want to go?" he said. His voice was soft, not unfriendly. I told him where I lived, and he said he knew it. "You're in luck," he told me. "I go past it on the motorway. About 5 miles from here, there's a fly-off where I can drop you. Couple of 100 yards and you'll be at your door. Can't take you any closer than that, I'm afraid, because my miles and fuel are monitored. Anyway, it's up to you. Maybe you feel safer calling a taxi." But I wasn't one to look a gift horse in the mouth. We left the cafeteria and went into the lorry park. He was cool and calm, in no hurry. I felt perfectly safe with him. In fact, I didn't give it a thought. His vehicle was one of those big articulated jobs, which we approached from the side and the rear. The headlights of a passing car as it flashed by on the motorway lit up in a swathe of light. The lorry had ice blue panels with white lettering saying Fridges Express. I remember it well because the white paint had peeled off one leg of the X, making it look like Ypres. But at the back of the lorry, my driver paused and looked at me and said,
"I just have to make sure this door is secure."
I stood beside him as he unlocked and slid up his roller door across the full width of the truck. A blast of ice-cold air came out, which made me shiver as it turned to a cloud of mist. Inside, there seemed to be rows of things hanging in there, but it was dark and I couldn't see what they were. He reached inside with both hands and did something, then looked over his shoulder and said, "It's okay," and I think it was then I realized I hadn't seen him smile, not once. He indicated we should go to the cab, and as he started to pull the door down again, I turned away from him. That was when he grabbed me from behind. One arm went round my neck and the other hand held something over my face. Of course, I gasped for air and got chloroform. I kicked and struggled, but that only makes you gasp even more. And then I passed out. When I came to, I was lying or slithering about on a patch of ice. That's what it felt like anyway. There was a smell, but I couldn't make out what it was. I was much too cold. All my senses were numb from the cold.
and I felt dizzy and nauseous from the chloroform. Then I remembered everything, and I knew I was in the back of the truck, slipping and slithering when he applied his brakes or accelerated. And of course I also knew I was in trouble, in fact, dead trouble. Whenever my driver wanted, he was going to get it, and then there was a fair chance that he'd kill me. I'd seen his truck. I could more or less describe him, if not, certainly later. It was odd, thorn I was a goner. I propped myself in one corner of the dark refrigerator. I suppose that's what it was, a large mobile fridge, a freezer truck, and tried to get some warmth back into my body. I hugged myself, blew on my hands, beat my arms about, but I was weak from the cold and the after effects of the chloroform. I didn't have the strength of a kitten. Then after, oh, I don't know how long, maybe 15 minutes, there was a bumpy patch and I heard his air brakes go on. To this day, I don't know where we were, for I never did see the outside again. The truck stopped. In a little while, the door rolled up and it was dark outside. A dark figure clambered up, panting, into the rear of the trailer. He pulled the door shut again and put on a dim interior light, just a single bulb, under a grill in the ceiling. And then he came for me. He was wearing a long coat, which was all dark stained leather on the outside and brown fur inside. He took it off as he approached me and threw it down on me. "Get on it," he said, panting with some weird emotion. But his voice was just as cold as the place where he planned to have me, which I now saw was a meat safe. Beast carcasses, all grey, brown and red, hung from rows of hooks, and the layer of ice on the floor was frozen beast blood. "There doesn't have to be any rough stuff," I told him. "We can do it just as you say." And freezing cold though I was, I opened my blouse and hitched up my mini to show him my frilly panties. He looked down at me in that unsmiling way of his, and I saw that his face was all puffy and bloated, and his eyes winking like little lumps of shiny coal in the swollen red mask of his face. "Just as I say," he repeated me. "Any way at all, and I swear I will be good. Only don't hurt me, and you can trust me. Afterwards, I won't say a word." I lied like hell. I wanted to live. "Take them off," he panted. "Everything." God, there was no soul behind his voice. Nothing behind his eyes. There was just the steam heat of his body and the pounding of his feverish blood. I could feel how strong he was and how weird and different. "Quickly," he said, and his voice was a croak and his gorged face was wobbling with strain and horrible excitement. I had to do what he told me. Keep him happy. But I was so cold my fingers wouldn't obey. I couldn't get my clothes off. He got down on one knee and I could see tools glinting in the loops of his wide leather belt. One of them was a meat hook, which he took out and showed me. When I gasped and turned my face away, he tore my jacket right off my back, my blouse too. Then he put the hook in the top of my skirt and ripped it down through the plastic belt and material, laying it open. He ripped open my panties in the same way, and all I could do was huddle there as cold as one of the dead animals on its hook. And I thought, what if he uses that hook on me? But he didn't, not the hook. Then he was tearing his clothes off. Not his upper clothes, just his pants. And I knew this was it. But a man as strong and as dangerous as this could hurt me badly. And I had to make it as easy for him, as easy for myself as possible. I opened my legs and stroked my bush of cold hair. And God help me, I tried to smile at him. "It's all here," I said, my words turning to snow as they came out. "All for you." "Yeah," he grunted, looking at me, his penis huge and jerking about on its own, with a life of its own. "All for me, all for Johnny, that." And then he smiled, and he took up another of his tools. This one was like a knife, but it was hollow, and it had been cut from steel tubing, about an inch and a half in diameter, cut at an angle to give it a sharp point, and its edges had been sharpened to razor brightness. "Oh, God," I gasped then, for I couldn't hold my terror any longer. And I clutched at myself and tried to cover my nakedness. But my driver, my all-too-soon-to-be murderer, that thing, he only laughed. There was no emotion in it, not as I understand emotion, but he laughed anyway. "Yes, cover yourself," he gurgled at me, the saliva in his lust overflowing from his wobbling, grimacing mouth. "Cover it up, girlie. Johnny doesn't want your ugly little fucky hole. Johnny makes his own holes."
He moved closer and his flesh was alive and leaping, bursting for me. And then...
It's okay. It was as much as Harry could bear. His voice was trembling, broken.
I know what, then. You've said enough. I'll go on what I have.
Pamela was crying now, spilling out her poor, mutilated soul, all of her defiance and resilience crushed and drained from her by the horror of what she'd forced herself to remember for the necroscope.
He made my body ugly, she sobbed. He made holes in me. Before I was dead, he was into me. And after I was dead, I could still feel him grunting on me, hurting me. It's not right when you're dead someone should still be able to hurt you, Harry.
It's okay, it's okay, was all Harry could say to comfort her. But even saying it, he knew it wasn't, knew it wouldn't be until he himself had put this thing right. She took this from his dead speak, understood his resolve, reinforced his anger with her own.
Get him for me, Harry! Get that dog's bastard for me!
And for myself, he told her, for if I don't, I know he'll always be there, clinging like slime on the walls of my mind. Pamela?
Yes?
Simply kenning this one won't be enough. I mean, it's just not enough. But if you're willing, there's a way you can help me. You're strong, Pamela, in death just as you were in life. And what I have in mind, I believe it's something you would enjoy even more than you did in life. He explained his meaning, and for a little while she was silent. Then,
I think I know now why the dead are afraid of you, Harry,
she said, wonderingly. And,
is it true that you're a vampire?
Yes. No, he said. Not like that. Not yet, anyway. And not here. But somewhere else I will be, or maybe, one day.
Yes.
He sensed her nod.
I think you must be, or will be, for nothing human could ever think the thought you thought just then. Nothing entirely human, anyway.
But you'll do it.
Oh, yes.
She answered him at last with a grim, emphatic, dead-speak nod.
Who, or whatever you are, I'll do anything you tell me, Harry Keogh. Vampire, necroscope, anything, everything, and whatever it takes to get even. Whatever you ask, and whenever you ask it, anything.
Harry nodded. So be it, he said. For the next 30-odd hours, the necroscope was busy. Not only him, but Ebranch too. And the next day, a warm evening in mid-May, the minister responsible caused the branch emergency call-in system to be brought into play. First, acting on disturbing information received from George Paxton concerning, among other things, the files Darcy Clark had mailed to Harry Keogh, the minister had relieved Clark of all duties and placed him under what amounted to house arrest at Clark's own North London flat in Crouch End. Second, he must now attend the O Group briefing he'd called at Ebranch headquarters. The Espers would know, of course, that something big was in the offing. All available agents were to be present. Paxton was there to meet the minister on the ground floor. Even as they exchanged curt greetings, Ben Trask, just back from a job, came in from the street through the swing doors. Trask looked drawn, even haggard. The minister took him to one side, where they conversed in lowered tones for a minute or two, and for once Paxton knew enough to keep his nose out. Then they all three took the elevator upstairs and went directly to the ops room. The called-in agents were silent, seated, waiting for the minister. He took the podium, and his eyes swept the mainly ordinary-looking faces of the Espers, Britain's ESP-endowed mind spies, where they stared back at him. He knew them all from photographs in their files, but only Darcy Clark and Ben Trask had ever met him. And Paxton, of course. If Clark had been here, perhaps he would have stood up as a sign of respect, and maybe the rest of them would have followed suit. Or then again, maybe not. The trouble with this lot had always been that they thought they were special. But here the minister knew he wasn't fooling anyone, least of all himself. They were special. Bloody special. And looking at them, he felt as several before him must have surely felt. Physics and metaphysics, robots and romantics, gadgets and ghosts, two sides of the same coin. Were they really? Science and parapsychology? the mundane and the supernatural, and he wondered what was the difference anyway. Isn't a telephone or radio magic? To speak with someone on the other side of the world, even on the moon? And has there ever been a more powerful, more monstrous spell or invocation than E equals MC squared? These were some of the minister's thoughts as he scanned the faces of E-branch's espers and put names to them. Ben Trask, the human lie detector, blocky, overweight, mousy-haired and green-eyed, slope-shouldered and lugubrious. Possibly Trask's sad expression sprang from the knowledge that the whole world was a liar, or if not all of it, a hell of a lot of it. It was Trask's talent to recognize whatever was false. Show him or tell him a lie, and he would know it at once. He wouldn't always know the truth of the thing, but he would always know that what was represented wasn't so. No facade, however clearly constructed, could ever fool him. The police used him a lot, to crack stone killers. Also, he came in handy in respect of international negotiations, when it was good to know if cards on the table made a full deck. David Chung, a young Londoner, a locator and scryer of the highest quality. He was slight, wiry, slant-eyed and yellow as they come. But he was British, loyal, and his talent was amazing. He tracked Soviet nuclear stealth subs, IRA units in the field, drug runners, especially the latter. Chung's parents had been addicts and their addiction had killed them. That's where his talent had started, and it was still growing. Anne-Marie English was something else, but weren't they all? 23, bespectacled, enervated, pallid and dowdy, she was hardly an English rose. That was a direct result of her talent, for she was as one with the earth, her way of defining it. She felt the rainforests being eaten away. She knew the extent of the ozone holes. When the deserts expanded, she felt their desiccation, and the mass erosion of mountain soil made her physically sick. She was ecologically aware beyond the five senses of mundane mankind. Greenpeace could base their entire campaign on her, except no one would believe. The branch did believe, and it used her like it used David Chung, as a tracker. She tracked illicit nuclear waste, monitored pollution and warned of invasions of Colorado beetle and Dutch elm disease, cried aloud the extinction of whales, elephants, dolphins and other species. And she knew that the earth was sick and growing sicker. She only had to look at the mirror each day to know that. Then there was Jeffrey Paxton, a telepath, one of several. An unpleasant person, the minister thought, but his talent was useful, and it takes all sorts to make a world. Paxton was ambitious. He wanted it all. Better to employ him where he too could be watched than have him turn to high-stakes blackmail or become the mind spy agent of some foreign power. Later, Paxton's would be a career worth following, and closely. 16 of them gathered here under one roof, and 11 more out in various parts of the world, guiding that world, or at least watching over it. They were paid accordingly to their talents, handsomely, and they were worth every penny. It would cost a lot more if they ever decided to work for themselves. 16 of them, and as the minister's eyes roved over them, so they studied him, a man who so far had kept himself to the shadows and would prefer to stay there, except that now some affairs of the utmost importance had lured him out. He was in his mid-40s, small and dapper, dark hair brushed back and plastered down, and he had no nerves to speak of, or none that were visible anyway. He wore patent leather black shoes, a dark blue suit and light blue tie. His brow had a few wrinkles, but other than these his face was normally unlined, and his eyes were bright, clear and blue. Right now, though, and especially since his conversation with Ben Trask, he was looking harried.
"Ladies and gentlemen," he wasn't one for preamble, "what I have to say would seem fantastic to almost anyone outside these walls, as would almost anything that goes on within them. But I'll try not to bore you with too many things you already know. Mainly, I've gathered you together to tell you we have one hell of a problem. First, I'll tell you how it came to be and how it came to light. Then you'll have to tell me how we're going to deal with it, in which instance I know that even the least of you, if there is such a thing, has more practical experience than I have. In fact, you're the only people with practical experience of these things, and so the only ones that can deal with the matter in hand." He took a deep breath, then continued. "Some time ago we appointed a traitor as head of E-Branch. I'm talking about Wellesley, yes. Well, he can't do any more harm, but after him it was my job to make sure it couldn't happen again. In short, we needed someone who was capable of spying on the spies. Now, I know you people have an unwritten code. You don't spy on each other, so I couldn't use one of you, not in situ anyway. I had to take one of you out of the branch and make him responsible to myself alone, and I had to do it before he could build up too many loyalties. So I chose Geoffrey Paxton, a relative newcomer, as my watcher over the watchers." He at once held up his hands, as if to ward off protests, though none were forthcoming, as yet. "None of you, I do mean none of you, were suspect in any way. But after Wellesley I couldn't take any chances. Still, I'd like to have it understood that your personal lives are still yours and no tampering. Paxton has always been under the strictest instructions not to interfere or pry into anything extraneous, but to confine himself solely to branch business, which is to say, branch security. A few weeks ago we had some business in the Mediterranean. Two of our members, Layard and Jordan, had come up against unpleasant opposition. It was the worst sort of business, but not without precedent. The head of E Branch, Darcy Clark, went out there with Harry Keogh and Sandra Markham to see what could be done. Later, Trask and Chung joined them, and they also had help from other quarters. As for qualifications, Clark and Trask both had experience of that sort of thing, and Keogh, well, Keogh is Keogh. If he could be reactivated, get his talents back, that would be a wonderful bonus for the branch. But initially, he went out as an observer and advisor, for no one knew more about vampirism than he did." And here he paused, perhaps significantly. "Now, we still don't know exactly what happened out there in Rhodes, the Greek islands, Romania. But we do know that we lost Trevor Jordan, Ken Layard, and Sandra Markham. I mean, lost them dead. So it can be seen they had a real problem, one which Darcy Clark would have us believe is now resolved. Harry Keogh, of course, could tell us everything, but so far he's chosen to tell us very little." By now the breathing of the minister's audience was quite audible, perhaps even heavy, impatient, and he saw that someone had stood up. Since a light was on the podium, he had to squint to see who it was on his feet back there in the shadows, but in a little while he made it out to be the very tall, skeletal, thin hunchman, or prognosticator, Ian Goodley. "Yes, Mr. Goodley?"
"Minister,"
Goodley answered, his high-pitched voice shrill but not unnaturally or unusually so.
"I know you won't be offended by any sort of imagined implication when I say that so far every word you've said has been spoken with absolute honesty and integrity. It came straight from the heart, was told the way you see it, and with the best of intentions. I don't think anyone here doubts that, or it takes a brave sort of man to come in here and try to tell us anything. Especially in the knowledge that there are people here who could pick your mind clean in a moment."
The minister nodded.
"I don't know about the bravery bit, but everything else is correct. What's more, it puts any sort of subterfuge right out of the question. It can be seen, you people can surely see, that I have no axe to grind. So, are you making a point, Mr. Goodley?"
"The point is that I do have an axe to grind, sir,"
Goodley answered quietly.
"We all do. And the way this briefing is going, it strikes me as likely we could have several axes to grind before you're through. Not with you, you understand. That would be pointless anyway, for my talent tells me that you're going to be our minister responsible for a long time to come. So, not with what you've said or what you think, but maybe what you've done, plan to do, or plan to ask us to do. Unless, of course, there are some damned good reasons."
"Do you mind explaining?" The minister's confusion was mounting. "But briefly, because I really do have to get on, and,
Explanations are easy.
Someone else was on his feet. No, her feet. Millicent Cleary, a pretty little telepath whose talent was as yet embryonic. She merely glanced at the minister but scowled furiously at the back of Paxton's head where he sat in the front row of seats.
Some explanations, anyway. I mean, it was inevitable we'd be monitored eventually, but by that.
And still scowling, she tossed her head to give the final word extra emphasis. She was pointing at Paxton. In his confusion, the minister had forgotten her name. He prided himself on not forgetting names. He looked at her, looked at Paxton.
Cleary, she said. Millicent.
And she breathlessly continued.
Paxton didn't follow your instructions. He simply ignored your orders. Branch security? Branch business? Oh, that was the handy excuse you gave him, which he scarcely needed. But other people's business, more like. And his nose right in it.
The minister was frowning. He looked harder at Paxton.
Can you be more specific, Miss Cleary?
But she wouldn't. She could, but wouldn't. What, tell everyone here that during Paxton's first month with the branch, she'd caught the shriveled little scumbag in her mind one night, playing with himself, to the purr of her vibrator and the tingling of her senses?
He looked at all of us.
Someone else saved her, his voice strong and gravelly.
He looked at the juicy bits, which, like it or not, we each and every one of us have, and he was doing it before you gave him his brief. Since then, why, by now he's probably looked at your juicy bits too.
And back to the gangling goodly again.
Minister, if you hadn't taken Paxton out of the organisation, we would have. He's about as trustworthy as a defective contraceptive. If AIDS was a psychic disease, all our brains would be shriveled to shit right now, all of them.
He paused to let that sink in, and after a moment,
so it seems to us that what you've done is to take away the one man we all trust, while at the same time giving us a watchdog who snaps at his keepers. Yes, and you've chosen one hell of a time to do it.
That was twice he'd cursed, and it wasn't Goodley's style to swear at all, not even mildly. Paxton had been cleaning his fingernails, apparently unconcerned, but now his ears reddened up a little. He stood up and turned round, glared at the others where they all stared at him in silent accusation.
My talent is unruly, he snapped. Also, it's eager, full of all the enthusiasm which you jealous bastards have lost. I'm still finding out about it, still experimenting. It isn't some bloody bonsai tree you can just force into any old shape.
Almost as one person, they shook their heads. They were the last people he should try to convince. His pallid, lame excuses wouldn't work on them. Each and every one of them had had it in for Paxton. Finally, Ben Trask spoke up, giving their single unified thought shape and substance.
You're a liar, Paxton, he said, quite simply.
And because Trask was what he was, he didn't have to enlarge upon his accusation. The minister felt like he'd bumped into a hornet's nest, and for his pains, or by them, was being driven off course, which he really couldn't afford to let happen. He held up his hands, took on a harder, more authoritative tone of voice.
"For God's sake, put your feuding and personal feelings aside," he cried. "At least for the moment, or for as long as it takes. Whatever else any one of you is or isn't, there's one thing we can at least be sure of. You're all human!"
Which hit them like a truck. Seeing that he now had their attention, and while he retained the upper hand, the minister turned pleadingly to Ben Trask.
"Mr. Trask, but level-headed, if you please, will you repeat what you told me downstairs?"
Trask looked at him grudgingly, but nodded.
"Only first, let me finish telling them what you started. You already know most of it, and have probably guessed the rest, so I'll get straight to it. And it just might come easier if they hear it from me."
"Very well," the minister replied,
and Trask began. "Zecphona gave us a helping hand in the Greek islands," he said. "You'll know who she is from the Keo files, what happened at Perchosk and on Starside, etc. She's a powerful telepath, one of the world's best, but like the Necroscope himself, she's opted out of cloak and daggery. Anyway, it was dodgy out there in the Med. We were killing vampires, and plenty of times they nearly killed us. but Harry took the brunt of it and went up against the big one, Janus Ferenczi, himself. And I know I don't have to tell you about the Ferenczis. When Harry was in Romania that last time, just before the end, Zack tried to get in touch with him to see how things were going. But telepathy over great distances isn't easy, and she didn't get too much. At least, that's what she told us. But we could see that what she did get shocked her, rigid. I know Darcy Clark has been worried stiff about it, for the fact is Darcy thinks the necroscope's the best thing since sliced bread. I know several of you also think so, and hell, so do I, or I used to. So, we did the job and came back, and as far as I know, Harry was successful too. It seems he made a great job of it, except he's been a bit cagey about what actually happened up in the Carpathians. Now me, I'm read too much into that, nor has Darcy Clark, for after all, Harry did lose Sandra Markham out there. So Darcy was going to let him get it off his chest in his own good time. For which, or so it would seem, Darcy's been sort of reduced to the ranks, decommissioned, busted, etc. But for what? That's what I'd like to know. For inefficiency, in that he maybe didn't want to prejudice an old friend? For holding back a while and not going off half-cocked? Or for having, shit, just a little faith? Both the minister and Paxton opened their mouths as if to butt in, but Trask cut them out with, "The thing you have to remember about Darcy Clark is this, that his talent doesn't go sneaking into other people's minds, eavesdropping or spying from a distance. All it does is look after Darcy. But he's kept in touch with the necroscope, and so far there's nothing to report. Darcy's talent didn't warn him of any immediate danger. If it had, you can bet your life he'd have been the first to yell. The last thing he'd want is for another Julian Badescu to be out and about." "But," Paxton started. "Shut your face," Trask told him. "These people are trying to listen to someone telling the truth. Only the truth." And he eventually continued. "Anyway, that was all yesterday, and today's today. And now things seem to have changed." He paused and looked at the minister. "Did you want to take it from there, sir?" The minister gave him a grim look and raised an eyebrow. "But you haven't told it all, Mr. Trask." Trask gritted his teeth but nodded, and after a moment, "I'm just back from a job," he said. "It's this serial killer thing we've been working on, these brutal, horrific murders of young women. The thing is, Darcy had approached Harry for his help on this one because, well, you know, that's what the necroscope is, the one man in the world who can talk to a victim after she's dead. And Darcy told him how Harry had been especially upset by the death of the latest one, a girl called Penny Sanderson. Well, 2 days ago, Penny turned up, like a bad penny, eh? But he wasn't grinning. Now, this girl was dead and gone forever, and yet suddenly here she is, right as rain, back home with her folks. And the point is, she couldn't have convinced them that she hadn't been murdered. They had seen her body. They'd known it was their daughter. They regarded her return as nothing short of a miracle. The police weren't happy with any of this. Oh, she had a story to tell, but it rang like a cracked bell. And if she really was Penny Sanderson, then who had been cremated? So the minister sent me up there to sit in on a standard police procedure interview. Of course, I was their lie detector. Well, she was, is Penny Sanderson. She wasn't lying about that. But she was lying about her loss of memory and what all. So knowing the Keogh connection, I just sort of thought to ask her if she knew him. Had she ever heard of him or met him? And she said no, never, and just looked blank. A barefaced lie. Which led me to my next question, except I didn't frame it like a question. I simply shrugged and said, "You're a lucky girl. It might easily have been you who was dead and not your double." And she looked me straight in the eye and said, "I'm sorry for her, whoever she was, but she was nothing to do with me. I didn't die." And again she was lying through her teeth. Well, I trust my talent. It's never let me down. She wasn't sorry for the other girl because there wasn't another girl. And her statement that she didn't die? A funny way of putting it at best, right? So the only conclusion I can come to is that Penny Sanderson did die, and that she's now back from the dead. The gathered espers let their air out in a concerted sigh. All of them. And Trask finished off with, "Of course, I couldn't tell the police she'd been, what the hell, brought back, resurrected. So I simply said she was okay. Just how okay she is, well, that's a different matter." At which point the minister responsible took his best yet opportunity to introduce a further item of damning information. Clark sent Keogh the files of all those murdered girls, and up in the castle on the mount in Edinburgh, he actually let the necroscope talk to Penny Sanderson, in his own way, you understand. Ben Trask, despite what he himself had just related, still wasn't 100% convinced. But at the time, wasn't that the idea, so that Harry could find out who killed her? The minister nodded. That was the idea. He dabbed at his face with a handkerchief. But a bad one, it now seems. It was Paxton's turn. He's a telepath, he said, his voice hard-edged, defiant. Harry? Ben Trask stared at him. Paxton nodded. He was into my mind like a ferret down a rat hole. He warned me off and told me he wouldn't be warning me again. Also, his eyes were feral. They shone behind those dark glasses he wears, and he doesn't much care for the sunlight. You've really been at hard work, haven't you? Trask growled. But this time he couldn't accuse him of lying. Look, said the other. I was given a job to do. Like the minister said, after Wellesley he couldn't take any chances, so when Clark came back from the Greek islands, I hooked into him. And I learned about his suspicion that maybe Keogh was a vampire. Another thing, Keogh told me to tell the minister that his worst nightmare had come true. Ergo, Keogh's a vampire. The minister was quick to add, that last isn't proven yet. But it is starting to look that way. The thing is, Keogh has had a lot of contact with these creatures. Close contact. Maybe this last time there was a little too much contact. Paxton again. Look, I know I'm a relative newcomer and you don't much like me, and in the past you've all had reasons to be grateful for Harry Keogh. But have these things blinded you to the facts? Okay, so you don't want to believe me. Don't even want to believe yourselves. But just think what we're up against if we're right. He can talk to the dead, who apparently know a hell of a lot. He uses the Mobius Continuum to go anywhere he wants to instantly, like we'd take a step into another room. He's a telepath. And now he not only speaks to the dead, but calls them back too. He could do that before, said Ben Trask, not without a shudder. But now he calls them back to what looks like life, Paxton was relentless. From their ashes, or undeath. At which David Chung gave a mighty start, reeled like someone had hit him and choked something out in Cantonese. Most of the espers were on their feet by now, but Chung gropingly found a chair and flopped down again. Frowning, the minister responsible said, Mr. Chung? Chung's pallor gave his face a sickly lemon tint. He wiped his shining brow and licked his lips, and again mumbled something to himself in Chinese. Then he looked up and his eyes were wide. You all know what I do, he said, his words a little sibilant and clipped in his fashion. I'm a locator, sympathetic. I take a model or a piece of something and use it to find the real thing. It's branch policy that I take and keep safe for each one of you a small item of your personal belongings. This is for your own safety. If you go missing, I can find you. Well, I also have several items belonging to Harry Keogh, stuff he's left here from time to time. It was out in the Mediterranean with the others. I knew Zekfona had been worried about something, and so I too had been keeping tabs on Harry. I told myself it was for his own good. But I knew what I was doing and what I was looking for. At first when I scried on him, it was just him. There was nothing different. It felt right. I got a picture of him, you know? Not doing anything, just a picture of him as I knew him, up there at his home in Edinburgh and wherever he was. But recently the picture has been dimmed, misty, and last night and this morning there wasn't much of Harry there at all. Just a mist, a fog. I was going to submit a report on it tomorrow.
In the old days, Trask said, we called that mind smog. It's what you get when you try to scan a vampire.
I know, Chung said.
He was more nearly recovered now.
It was partly that which hit me, and partly something else. Paxton said that Harry could call dead people up from their ashes. That's what hit me the most.
What? The minister was frowning again. Chung looked at him.
I also have things which used to belong to Trevor Jordan, he said. And this morning, just by accident, I happened to touch one of them. It was like Trevor was right there, right next door or down the street, and I thought it was something out of my memory. It was there and then it was gone, but it just struck me that he very well could just be here, just down the street. The minister still hadn't taken it in, but Trask soon took care of that. Pale as a ghost, he whispered, "My God!" Jordan was cremated out in Rhodes, burned to ashes in case he'd been infected with vampirism. But Jesus, now that I think of it, I remember how it was Harry Keogh who insisted on it.
Part 2. 4 years earlier. Chapter 1. The Icelands. The great Vampiri lords Balaf, Lesk the Glut, Menor Membite, Lascula Longtooth and Torn Tornbody were no more. All of these and many lesser Vampiri lights, their lieutenants and warrior creatures, all wiped out by the Dweller and his father in the battle for the Dweller's Garden. The battle was lost. The kilometre-high eyries of the Vampiri, all except the Lady Karens, reduced to so much stone, bone and cartilage rubble by the massed explosions of methane-belching gas beasts, and the Vampiri masters of Starside themselves brought low in the aftermath of their humiliating defeat. Now Scythis, once leader of the vampire army, turned his hybrid flyer's head into a wind whistling out of the bitter north, and rising on its waft, set course for the Icelands. He was not the first of the Vampiri to venture that way. Over the centuries others had gone before him, exiled or fled there, and after the battle at the garden certain survivors of his army had headed that way too. Better the Icelands, whatever they held in store, than the awesome weapons of the Dweller and his father. Aye, those two, father and son, mere men, but men with talents. Men come out of the hell lands beyond the sphere gate, who use the power of the sun itself to blow away the protoplasmic, metamorphic flesh of the Vampiri into superheated gas and stinking evaporation. Harry Keogh and his son, called the Dweller, they had destroyed Scythus's army, ruined his plans, reduced him almost to nothing. But almost nothing is still something. And in all creation there does not exist anything more tenacious than a vampire. Scythis, if it were at all possible, and given even the smallest opportunity, would build on what vestigial power was left to him, to become something again. And if when the day should come, then the Helllanders would pay. Yes, and all who had stood alongside them in the Battle of the Garden. Lady Karen had stood with them, treacherous Vampiri bitch. Scythis jerked hard on the leather reins, yanking the gold bit in his flyer's mouth, until it tore the flesh there. The creature, once man, a traveller, but hideously changed through Scythis's mutative art, uttered a complaining grunt through pluming nostrils and flapped its manta wings more rapidly, lifting higher still in the frosty air, as if to reach for the cold diamond stars. Behind Scythis, suddenly the mountains were split by a golden bomb burst of searing light. A slither of sunlight struck like a spear at him from beyond the barrier mountains, from Sunside. He felt it glance against his robe of black bat fur and cringed, and knew that he'd flown too high. Sun up. The sun's slow creep was bringing its molten yellow rim into view. Cold as he was, Scythus could feel it burning on his back. Mind linked to a flying beast made in large part from a man, now Scythus instructed his weird mount,
"Glide."
A waste of mental effort, however small, for the flyer too had felt the sun's menacing rays. Its enormous manta wings tilted upwards at their tips and stilled their pulsing. Its head went down as it slid into a shallow glide. Scythus sighed his relief and returned to his black brooding. Lady Karen, a mother, some said, whose vampire would one day bring forth 100 eggs out of her body. There would be eyries again on Starside, in some unforeseen future, and all of them inhabited by Karen's black brood, and the bitch herself, hive queen of all Vampiri. Doubtless there would be a truce between Karen and the Dweller, peace between them, even bonds of flesh.
How that could ever be, Scheithers was at a loss even to think. But hadn't he with his own eyes seen Harry Keogh and Karen together in her stack, her Eirion Starside, which alone stood where all the rest were tumbled into ruins? Karen. Without exception, each and every vampire lord had lusted after her body and her blood. And if things had gone their way in the battle for the Dweller's Garden, Scheithus would have been the first with her. Now there was a thought to save her. Karen. Scheithus remembered her as he had once seen her at a meeting of all the Vampiri lords in Karen's Eyrie. Her hair was burnished copper. Seeming to burn, it bounced like fine-spun gold on her shoulders, competing with the golden bangles she wore on her arms. Gold rings on a slender golden chain around her neck supported her clinging sheath of a gown, which left her jutting left breast and right buttock exposed, or very nearly, so that with no undergarments the effect had been explosive. If the lords who saw her like that had worn war gauntlets, and if the meeting's agenda had been anything less than the utmost importance, then certainly the lustier lords might have fought over her. And who among the Vampiri was not lusty? From one pale, perfect shoulder had depended a smoky black cloak, skilfully woven from the hair of a Desmodus, which shimmered with a weave of fine golden stitches. On her feet, sandals of pale leather, similarly stitched in gold, and dangling from the lobes of her ears, golden discs fretted with her sigil, which was the head of a snarling wolf. She had been breathtaking. Scheithus had felt the thoughts of his fellow lords turn hot as their blood, and he'd known they all wanted to be into her. Even the thoughts of the slyest, most devious of them, Scheithus himself, had been diverted, which of course had been the witch's purpose. Aye, a clever one, Karen. He could still see her burning on his mind's eye.
Her body had the sinuous motion of traveller woman when they danced, which yet seemed so unaffected as to be innocent. Her face, heart-shaped, with a lock of that fiery hair coiled on her brow, likewise could have been innocent, except her red eyes gave her away. Her mouth was full, curved in a perfect bow. The colour of her lips, like blood, was accentuated by her purple, slightly hollow cheeks. Only her nose marred looks otherwise entirely stunning. It was a fraction tilted, stubby, with nostrils just a little too round and dark. And perhaps her ears, half hidden in her hair, showed whorls like the strange orchids of Sunside. Beautiful, but...
Vampiri, aye.
Scheithus shivered, even Scheithus. Not from the cold, but from his lust, and from his loathing. It was a tremor which coursed through him like the vibrations of a gong, and it was the sure recognition of his ambition. To destroy the Dweller had been all of it, upon a time. But now there was more.
One day, Karen,
Scheithus promised himself out loud, his voice a low rumble.
One day, if there is justice, I shall have you. Ah, and while I fill you to brimming on the one hand, on the other I'll empty you to the last drop. I will feed a straw of gold directly into your heart, and for every milky dribblet your sex drains from me, I shall suck a spurt of scarlet from you. Thus, of our depletions, mine will be temporary, while yours, alas, will be permanent. So shall it be.
It was his Vampiri oath, and scowling into the bitter wind, Scheithus flew north. The sun's slow rising over Sunside could not catch Scheithus of the Vampiri. Flying, however, slowly round the curve of the vampire world towards its roof, still his going was faster and farther than the sun could chase him. so that in a little while he reached and passed that margin beyond which the sun's rays never fell, and after that he knew that he was in the Icelands. Scheithers had never been much of a one for legends and histories. Of the Icelands he knew only those details which were items of gossip, or matters of common knowledge. That the sun never shone there was self-evident, but rumours also had it that if one crossed the polar cap and kept going, then he'd find more mountains and fresh territories for the conquering. No one in living memory had tested the legend, however, at least not of his own free will, for the great stacks of Starside had been the places of the Vampiri, their homes and the Eyries since time immemorial. But that was yesterday, and now it appeared that the myth would be tested in full. As for the creatures of the Icelands, in the margins of its oceans, some said great hot-blooded fish spouted, vast as the mightiest warriors and with shovel mouths that scooped the sea for smaller prey. They swam there from some eastern ocean, along a warm river that ran in the sea itself. It sounded like a lie to Scheithers. Aye, and there were bats too, which also ate the smallest fishes. These were miniature albino, and dwelled in caverns of ice, and were attuned to the Vampiri's mind, as were the kith and kin in more hospitable parts. Another myth to be tested. Other than the whales and the snow bats, Scheithers had heard of bears like the small brown bear of